The booze was so loud. But instead of feeling smaller and shriveled up, I didn't shrivel up. I actually felt empowered because I realized, like, these people don't know me. You know, they don't know what I've been through. They don't know how hard I've worked for this moment. And I just got to go out here and handle business. And that's what I did.
Welcome to a special episode of the Mind Athlete Track and Field Podcast. My guest today is Justin Gatlin, Olympic gold medalist, multiple world champion, and one of the greatest sprinters in history. In this episode, we talk about his legendary victory over Usain Bolt in the 2017 World Championship Final, how he trained his explosive starts and top-end speed, and his current projects, including his podcast, Ready, Set, Go, and his new book, Ready, Set, Go, From Grind to Glory.
Ben, welcome, Justin.
Appreciate it. Thank you for having me, Benjamin.
Before we dive into specific topics, I would love to hear what's been keeping you busy in these days.
You know what? Running my mouth. Everyone says, are you still running? I said, no, I'm running my mouth now. So I've actually started, similar to you, I've started the podcast, not as long and luxurious as yours has gone, but we started the podcast with one of my best friends, and we just have organic conversation with different athletes and help build their platforms. But you know all this. And you know, I can't put the running down and the exercising down. So I still go out there and I still kind of get some runs in and I get some different, you know, workouts in the gym. And I just finished writing a book. So yeah, just kind of tackling those small things that I had as, I guess you call them, the kids would call them side quests. The side quest that I have now that the main thing is done, I'm trying to tackle things that would be dear to my heart. So that's what I'm working on now.
So what's the name of your podcast and also the name of your book?
Podcast is Ready, Set, Go. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it on Spotify. You can find it on Apple. Basically anywhere there's a platform for podcast, you can find it. And my name of my book, coincidentally, is also Ready, Set, Go. So it's Ready, Set, Go, From Grind to Glory. I'll show you a little picture of it. So when people are watching, they can see what they're looking for. So that's what it looks like.
You also mentioned that you're still working out. Are you still running sprints, like 300 meters or 200 meters?
I'm still doing more like speed endurance workouts. Not so much heavy like speed workouts, but just to keep myself in shape. I love the way my body looked when I was in training and competing. And as you become older, you know what I mean? Your body doesn't respond as well. But I learned that habits is the way of life, right? So if you have bad habits, they're going to control the way you look, the way you feel. Same thing with good habits. They're going to control the way you look and the way you feel. So I love the way I looked. You know what I'm saying? I always looked, I was ready, felt like a superhero, abs and pecs and shoulders. And it's the same thing with just creating good habits as I become older, you know, more seasoned Justin Gatlin.
How many times a week you still train?
It might be about, depending on what I have to do. So you're looking at maybe 3 times a week. I'm okay. Getting it in. I actually just came back from a birthday celebration with a Safa pal. And we actually was having a conversation over a drink. And I was like, you know what? We should do a Spartan run. A Spartan run is like 10K with obstacles in the way. So, you know, we were doing our little hit workouts and everything. And I was like, I'm up for a challenge if you're up for a challenge. So we've been talking about it here and there. So we'll see if it happens.
We exchanged a few messages before this episode. And I would like to dive into the World Championships final in London 2017. I watched a talk you gave at a high school where you shared your experience and perspective on that race. And for me, it was an unforgettable moment in athletics. So could you walk us through the race from your perspective?
Yeah, for sure. I'll let you start off. Where would you like to start from?
When you entered the stadium, what was the atmosphere like and what were you thinking as you faced the track?
I knew that in the beginning, it was going to be a challenge. And why I say is because it was Usain Bolt's last race, right? His last 100 meters, his last world championship, his last time standing on top of a podium in front of an audience that loves him. The UK is like his second home. They have adopted him. They love Usain. So I knew the recipe was to have a fairy tale ending, you know? And I think from one competitor to another, it was never about raining on someone's parade. It was just the fact of, we both know that when you step to the line, it's all bets are off. Like, I'm here to try to win. Like, you're here to try to win. We're here to try to get it in, you know? And once I stepped on that line, I realized that it wasn't going to be just a physical challenge today. It was going to be a mental challenge. And I received mental warfare from the audience, you know, like the loud boos, the deafening boos, but also the fact of the opposite for him, which was overwhelming cheers, you know. So it really gave me the understanding, the perception of what good and evil, black hat versus white hat, and that's the feeling of it. But at the end of it, you know, I realized that everything I did to get to that point, I worked hard for it day in, day out. And my objective was to go out there and run the best race I could run. And that's what the whole goal was. So day one, it was, you know, prelims, lane one, lane two. And it got to my lane. It was kind of like, boo, like low boo. So I was like, all right, that's kind of weird. All right. Because no one wants to get boos, you know?
Yeah.
And then the next day for the semis, the boos got louder. Boo. So it was definitely a trending thing. And then an hour and a half later or less going into the finals, it was that same energy, but times 10. So the boos were so deafening that, you know, I thought I killed a bag of cats or something. Like it was crazy. But as I stood there and I always thought to myself, what would you do? There's always things that you think about as a sprinter, you know, or a runner. And there's things that you feel like would embarrass you or stop you or take you out of your zone. And I think either false starting, falling flat on your face, or getting boos are all in that same list, right? So never want to get booed, never wanted to false start or fall flat in my face. And the boos were so loud. But instead of feeling smaller and shriveled up, I didn't shrivel up. I actually felt empowered because I realized, like, these people don't know me. You know, they don't know what I've been through. They don't know how hard I've worked for this moment. And I just got to go out here and handle business. And that's what I did.
But how did you build a mindset like this? I mean, how do you manage to stay focused in a moment like this?
I just think part of it was naturally my competitive spirit. I've always felt like if you say I can't, I'm going to figure out how I can. And then the other part was just having the pride just to be there, you know, the pride of wearing my country on my chest and not faltering. You know, I've watched, especially within the era of Bolt, I watched so many athletes just succumb not only to losing to Bolt, but also the fact of, like, you could tell mentally they checked out. And I felt like, what's a better way to test who you are than against the fastest human alive? The fastest human in history. And that was my whole objective. My whole objective from the moment I saw him become Bolt in 2008, as I sat and watched the Olympics on TV, I was like, that guy, I want to race that guy. Not because I want to race him to beat him, because I want to race him because I want to test my mettle. I want to test my might. I want to test how good I am against someone like that. And that's what actually started a whole process of me getting back on that horse and climbing that ladder to success, and then just telling myself, like, I just want to be lined up shoulder to shoulder with this guy and race against him at our peak at our fastest. And it was just full of respect, to be honest. I just wanted to do it. It's almost like, I don't know if you watch anime, but it's almost like, it's like Goku. When Goku fights, you know what I'm saying, really, really challenging competitors or oppositions, it's like, I just want to see how good I can be. And that's really what it was for me.
So what do you think is for you the key takeaway from that final?
The key takeaway for me was, for me, it's always been in my career, it's bet on myself. Believe who I am. If I believed what the audience thought of me, I would have just shriveled up. I would have came in fifth place because at 50 meters, I was already in fifth place. And I just would have just, they would have knew who I was. And there was no way for me to change that. So I stuck to what the plan was, which is actually was a plan B instead of a plan A. And I went out there and actually trained for the last 2.5 weeks, worked on my top end speed. And the critical zone of the last 20 meters was so important for me to be able to capture, because races before that, that's where I faltered, especially against Usain. And I think the hardest thing for me throughout what races leading up to that, even like seasons back, was that any race I raced against Usain, I was losing in the last 20 meters of that race, for sure, right? And I just said, F it, let's change it. Let's work on top end speed. Let's meet him at the last 20 meters and see what we can do. And I just started working on it with my coach, and we started getting better, started having more confidence with it, start being more technically sound of the last 20 meters. And I prevailed. I went from fifth place with 50 meters to go to first place with still a little bit of cushion and daylight between me and Christian Coleman. So it actually paid off.
How do you train your top end speed and those weeks before?
You know, I couldn't get the start that I was known for at that point in time. Obviously, before Christian Coleman came along, I was the fastest starter, right? And that's what I always banked on, getting out in front of the field and beating them and making the field run to my cadence. You know, 99% of the people I compete against in the world, I could beat them with that technique and that race pattern. It was just that 1%, that one guy, that I had to change my whole philosophy. I had to change my whole running style for that one guy. And it was a very humbling experience. So a lot of it came with a lot of 120s, a lot of overspeed stuff. So by the time I would start to fatigue and I'll start to wane and I'll start to kind of rig up a little bit, or I would just get too excited because I see the finish line coming, I'd learn how to be able to stay patient within those zones and just keep stepping down and keep my arm swing moving and just finish through the finish line, not slowing up, but just going right through the finish line.
And you said before, you were also known for your explosive power. And how do you develop that? How did you develop that strength, that power?
Weight room, a lot of resistance. Like, I did a lot of sled pulls, especially from after 14. I just had this thing where I was like, 12 was good. I got on the podium at the Olympics in 2012. 2013, I got silver in Moscow. 2014, I was undefeated that whole season. No one beat me. And then between 2014 and 2015, I just said to myself, I was like, I'm trained all the way up to this point, and then I just use that point just to compete at. And I was like, what if I trained beyond that point? What if I just told my body, just keep going? So I would try to like not limit myself in different places. So like if we had sled pulls with 45-pound weights and we had to pull the sled for 60 meters, I would do crazy stuff like Benjamin. I would put another 45-pound plate on top of that and pull it for 60 meters. And I just would start telling myself, pain is inevitable. Like, you're going to feel pain, but what is the reward after the pain? Is it going to be marginal reward, or is it going to be a level of success that you've never seen before? And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to get to a level of success that I'd never experienced before. And that's how I started training. So even when I got in the gym and I started doing traditional squats, like, I would look to try to PR as often as I could, or on the bench as often as I could, or even runs. Like, I would tell myself, and you know, as a runner, we always want to bend over and grab our knees between reps. I told myself, discipline lies in the mind. And down to the small things, I told myself, no matter how tired I would get, I would never bend over and touch my knees. I'd always stay up here. I always keep my chest cavity open, and I always would breathe through my nose. Small little habits, I wanted to change everything from small habits to big habits. And in 2015, I ran, what, 9.5, 9.7s. I had an amazing, amazing season that season. But that one thing that I didn't work on was that last 20 meters. And it showed at World Championship of 2015 when Usain edged me out. So I still had growth. I still had things I needed to work on.
You talk a lot about habits. How do you evolve those habits?
For me, it's always been any coach that I go to, I just become an open book. You know, even after winning a gold medal in 2004, a lot of people would be like, well, you've won already. You've been to the top. So who can tell you how to win? You already know how to win. I was like, yeah, but the thing I love about track and field, like, is always evolving. New runners, new techniques, new modalities, all these new things. If I kept myself closed up saying, I know how to win in 2004, but 2004 doesn't mean I know how to win in 2017, you know? So I had to realize that I had to humble myself and say, let's relearn each year. Let's learn different techniques. Let's learn how to be a better runner. So when you look at my videos from 2004, I was a very long strider. I would open up. But now when you look at 15 and beyond, I kind of like was more compressed. I was stepping down. I was using the track to generate momentum. So I just had a whole new running style. And that's unheard of in our sport, because usually whatever you did to get success, we usually stay with that same pattern until it's time for us to retire.
Many young sprinters listen to this podcast and they don't have right now the same strength as you. What tips would you give them to still accelerate efficiently?
So I would say, let's take it back a little bit, right? Before we get to the acceleration part.
Yeah.
Because any young sprinter who's listening or any young athlete that's listening, like, you need to change this before you can change this. Because if I give you tips and you go out there and you just do it, right? You're learning physically how to do it. But when it's time for you to be tested mentally or emotionally, you're going to fall and revert back to what is safe to you, which is your old ways, right? So I would say change who you are, like relearn, like go back. If you read a book, read it from the beginning again. That's exactly the same philosophy. Know who you are, then now change those bad habits, change those small things that's holding you back, and then look for something different. But to be able to learn how to accelerate properly, a lot of core workouts, right, to keep your abs. A lot of runners don't realize that your core is actually your secret weapon. Your core is what's going to keep your technique. The core is going to keep you stabilized. Your core is going to help you generate momentum as you push into the ground. You don't want to get none of this rocking stuff and this movement. That's all wasted movement while you're running. So work on core. I would say also the chain that you have, the triple extension chain, calves, quads, glutes. Those, so if you're using those kind of things when it comes to squats or power lifts, those things, work on your quads, because that's where you're going to push from. And remember, hamstrings are important, but they're not as important as when you want to accelerate as your quads are. So I would think of, as you're pushing down the track, the thing that's going to help you accelerate is also your shoulders. When you look at any athlete that has superior speed over the masses, men and women, their shoulder caps are defined, from a Sha'Carri to a Shelly Ann to now a Noah to a Usain to myself to Tyson to Carl Lewis to Maurice Green. Any sprinter that you've seen, Michael Johnson, any sprinter you've seen that has defied the odds, have done something abnormal and run super fast, you look at their shoulder caps. That's where your motor really is. This is going to dictate how fast you run. If you run and you're moving your arm this fast, your legs can only move that fast. So you realize that it's not so much lower body dominant that's really going to be critical. It's actually the cadence that you keep and the power output you keep with your shoulders and your arms moving up top.
So from my own experience as a sprinter, I also know how crucial technique can be. For me, ankle stiffness and early knee extension were major challenges that negatively affected my acceleration. So what advice would you give sprinters struggling with these kinds of problems?
For me, what I worked on was a lot of cable pulls. When it came to resistance, I'll do resistance pulls. I would isolate each leg. I would either do, I guess, a strap around my ankle, right? And do cable pulls from there. Or I would do, it's like a pivot machine, right? And then it has like a little cushion where you would put your knee there and you would push it forward, right, for your knee. Ankle stiffness, I did a lot more of barefoot exercises on the grass to be able to kind of just naturally strengthen my ankles and my feet as well. You don't want to do too much on especially smaller areas, but you want to be consistent in what you do in those smaller areas. Because if you overload them, then you're going to have a problem, right? Because they don't have major muscles in those areas. But you want to make sure you're consistently doing that so you can strengthen those areas.
So acceleration and top speeds are the essence of sprinting, but beyond the track, the sport itself evolving with the Grand Slam track series starting in 2025. I would love to hear your thoughts on how this might change the landscape of athletics.
I'm very curious to see how it's going to go. You know, obviously, Michael Johnson has cooked up a really good whole new league for our sport. Obviously, it's kind of created from his success, which is doubling. So now each athlete is going to have to go out there and double. I just had a couple questions. I want to know is like, are all these athletes, they have to double, right? Or is it kind of like, if they choose to, and then obviously they're going to forego the points if they don't, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to keep them out of the winning pot because obviously they didn't score as many points. So I'm curious to see. I'm excited, to be honest. You know what I mean? It's been a long time coming that we need a change in our sport, you know, and I'm old enough to realize and watched the era of Michael Johnson, watch a lot of videos from Carl Lewis, watching Maurice Greene come along and watching how exciting track and field was then, you know, like they were doing things that just was exciting. Like if you broke an American record at certain meets, you would get a car or a boat,
yeah,
something cool. You know what I mean? That everyone loves money, you know what I mean? To a certain extent, but it's like, you want to race for something that's a little more tangible, you know what I mean? That makes it a little more exciting. So I want to see that kind of like vibe come back into track and field where, and I like the fact that Grand Slam, especially their rollout, it gave the athletes the opportunity to show their character, show their personality or persona through their intros. So that's a really good thing too to see.
So you think that's important to elevate the sport? Stuff like this?
Absolutely. Yeah. I think if we're looking to acquire more audience outside of people who understand the sport down to the nuts and bolts of things, we're going to have to show the athlete's persona. That's the only way to go, because getting people from the outside to understand and translate, oh, a 9.7 actually is like about 27 miles per hour or 26 miles per hour. They're going to be, that is what they understand, especially in America. They don't understand meters. They understand feet or yards. They don't understand what a 9.7 looks like, 9.8 looks like. When you equate it to miles per hour, they understand that. They're amazed by that. Even when it comes, I know that they're not going to have field events, but even when it comes to jumps, like people on the outside have to compare it to something that's amazing. Like this female athlete can jump as long as a city bus. That's amazing. People want to see things like that. And on top of that, they want to see character. I think that's one thing that made, you know, a lot of these young athletes who they are today, like a Noah Lyles, is because he showed more of his character. He backed it up on the track. But the sound bites and the highlights that we've heard from him was also just as entertaining. And that's what we're looking for. I think that's what the world's looking for. Speak. You only get 9 seconds. You only get 9 seconds to show the world who you are. You don't get 4 quarters. You don't get 2 halves. You get 9 seconds. So at least you could do is show us who you are off the track. Be your character. Be you.
Yeah, Noah, he's also a lot of into those challenges. He was running against 2 guys on Instagram in the last couple of weeks. You saw those,
Mr.
Right?
Beast.
Yeah, Mr. Beast.
Mr. Beast and Speed. Yeah. He has definitely birthed the competitiveness in Speed, because Speed is out there talking about he's gonna get ready for 2028 Olympics, and he almost got Noah. You know, I want to say to him, was like, you realize he's in fall training, like he's not even like has done any speed work yet. So when you see him in June or July, that's when you really need to race Noah, because that's when he's gonna show you what his true speed is.
So you've competed in so many different formats and against the best sprinters in the world. Along the way, you also built some incredible relationships, like with Asafa Paul. You said you was on his birthday last week. So can you share how these connections have influenced your experience in the sport?
I think I always had a vision that throughout my time of competing, and I'm a fierce competitor, right? And we come from an era, especially me and Asafa, we come from an era where we were birthed from the Dennis Mitchell and the Carl Lewis era, which was gritty, aggressive, you're taking food off my table and money out of my pocket kind of mentality. And so those coaches taught us that same mentality, like, you want to be the best, you got to beat everyone around you, and you can't be nice about it. So I think for a long time, for almost 20 years, me and Asafa, we're going like head to head, and we never got an opportunity to know who each other was. I respected him and I revered him on his talent. Every time he stepped to the plate, he was running one of the fastest times in the world or breaking a world record. He was doing that, you know? He was the essence of speed, you know? To the point where he made me change my whole contract to where my contract read, if I get on the podium, that's my bonus. I have to get on the podium so I wouldn't get reduced. Because Asapa would go somewhere and run around the world and he would get the number one time in the world. And now either I had to chase him for the time, and if I don't get the number one time in the world, I was going to get reduced. So I had to change that in my contract. That was a nightmare. So, but I think now, I just, when I sat down with Asapa for the first time and we had dinner in Jamaica, I realized we had so much in common outside of just being sprinters. Like, we had the same temperament. We thought alike. We are at the same phase of our lives, even after retiring, being a father to young kids, you know, being a husband. And what are you looking to do next? How are you looking to reinvent yourself? How are you looking to capture your next passion? Being uncertain on certain things, but still being confident in who you are. So that connection, that vibe was there. And that's when I realized, like, man, like, this is a real bond. We could really make a real genuine bond and friendship from this. And we did. Like, we started texting each other, like, funny stuff. Hey, bro, what's going on, bro? Next thing you know, he's like, hey, man, come to the party, man. I got there and I'm literally like the only athlete other than himself that was there. Like, he had really close friends who really meant something to his life. You know what I mean? Who is his circle. And I was honored to be a part of, invited to his birthday to feel like I was part of his circle.
I can imagine you share these connections because you both went through a similar journey. I mean, competing at such a high level under immense pressure. Back in the day when you were competing against each other, I assume there wasn't much talking in the call room before a race. However, you likely shared the same emotions before and after races, as well as the overall journey. That must give you plenty to talk about when you're reflecting your careers.
Never. We never actually had a full-on conversation when we were competing against each other. I saw him at a club one time after a race. I think maybe like Zurich or Lausanne, something along those lines. And we were at the club. He was sitting in one section. I was in another section. But they were really close together. And we looked up. We caught eyes. And he was like, I was like, sure. We had a drink. He passed me a bottle. We cheers each other. And from that moment, I was like, oh, you're not a bad guy. All right, cool. You know, so I think that is where it started from. And I realized, like, you know, your toughest competitors, especially after you retire, are going to be the people who could actually, you can bond with the closest.
Yeah. So, but outside of athletics, what are your passions and interests right now?
You know what? At one point in time, I was like, I'm going to step away from track and field and venture out and find something else to do. And I'm going to be successful in something totally outside of track and field. I'm going to be like, ha, I don't need track and field to be successful. And then I realized my love is in track. I watch track. Through my lowest points of my career, I still watch track. I'm a fan of track. I love track. I love watching people capture those moments they work so hard for because I know what it feels like. I feel for those athletes who fall short on capturing what was supposed to be their goal and then watching them recline that ladder to success and then finally doing it. I love to see that pressured competition on the track where they're shoulder to shoulder, everyone's primed and ready to run. I am just a fan of track and field, man. And I couldn't see myself not being a part of track and field. And I also thought about, I was like, man, do male sprinters, when they leave the sport, either they just kind of fade into the abyss and really don't do much in track and field, and they just kind of live their own life and do their thing. But I want to change that narrative. I want to still be present in track and field because everyone wants to be the fastest. You know what I mean? No matter what event you do, everyone wants to run 100 at least one time. You know what I mean? And I think that the knowledge that I've acquired over 20 years, I wanted to be able to give it back to people who really wanted to listen, you know? And I feel like it would have been an injustice for me to just be like, I'm going to take all this knowledge I have to the grave. Is someone out there who really needs the tidbits of information I can give?
Absolutely.
The good, the bad, the ugly, and they can be able to capture whatever their dreams and goals are. So that's been my goal. And that's why I started the podcast, was is giving these athletes a platform that can speak on them, you know? And for me, that's what it is. I do speaking engagements now. So I travel around the United States and I do speaking engagements. I tell different aspects of my career and story, and I parallel it to whatever the events that I'm going to. And usually they're more corporate events. So I'm telling a room full of wholesalers in the insurance world what it feels like at that moment when you're lined up against seven of the other fastest people on the earth. And what does that feel like? That you know that you're about to make history when that gun goes off. And they're so locked in. And they're realizing, like, this is an amazing thing that I'll never be able to understand or feel.
It is amazing.
Yeah. So it's cool. I really enjoy the path and the journey that I'm going on now. And I know that it's not my last stop. So there's a lot of the things that I'm working on coming down the pipeline. And for all my friends out there listening, if you ever have any kind of tidbits and be like, Justin, you'd be good at this. I'm all ears listening to.
So before we close the episode, I want to ask you something I think all our listeners find interesting. So I have always five mandatory questions. And the first one is always, what was the most beautiful or emotional competition of your whole career?
Winning the Olympic gold in 2004. I feel like it equates to any sport. If you were a football player, American football player, it's like winning Super Bowl, American basketball player, winning the NBA Finals, you know, soccer player, World Cup. So for me, in my sophomore season of track and field, winning the Olympic gold was like a dream come true for me. Like, it was an experience like no other. It was the first and last time I've ever, and while I'm running, I envisioned myself, a small version of myself in my head, jumping up and down and saying, you're about to win the Olympics, oh my God. Like, it was an amazing feeling. And when it happened, it just was pure joy. Hasn't been replicated since. So it was amazing.
What was going through your mind at that moment when you crossed the finish line?
I was beside myself. Like, if you watch the video, like, I come across the finish line, I realize that I won, but I don't understand the magnitude of how important this moment is, not only for myself, but for the whole world, because the whole world stops to watch who is going to be crowned the fastest man in the world. We know that. So we've seen it, we witnessed it. And for that moment, I didn't realize how big it was, because I was just so worried about my own personal victories, how hard I trained for this moment. And now this moment is here and I accomplished it. And then I realized, like, wow. Like, there's 100,000 people in the stadium and millions of people at home watching, and everyone's going crazy. So it was surreal, very surreal.
And on the other side, which competition was the most challenging for you and why?
The most challenging, I'd say, for me is 2015, faltering like 10 meters before the finish line and losing that world championships, because that was like arguably the best season I've had of my career, where I think I ran all sub 10 except for one race where I purposely tried to run slow. My coach was like, you don't have to run 9.7 every time you step on the track. So I was like, all right, coach, I'll try to slow down. I ran like 10.0 or something like that. But within that season, I just found my rhythm and it felt amazing. I felt unstoppable. And once I got to the finals, I realized that I wasn't competing wholeheartedly. I was just out there physically, but I wasn't out there mentally and emotionally. And I thought I was going to be able to put Bolt away earlier in that race. And the true competitor in him came out, and he went out there and gutted out like a 9.79, and I ran 9.80. And I stumbled into the line because I wanted to finish the race, because I thought I'd be in front of somebody. And that whole race, that whole season, I was meters in front of everybody. So it was a foreign feeling to have someone with me running stride for stride. So when I came across the line, I realized that it wasn't necessarily that he beat me. It was the fact that I beat myself. I didn't come to that starting line respecting the process, respecting the competitors, and I came half-cocked.
So did you work with a mental coach?
Luckily, I mean, I've always been a mentally tough guy. And I would say that that has been a credit to my career and the longevity of my career is being mentally tough. But I also had it in my coach at that point in time, Dennis Mitchell. He was a mental coach. Not only would he train you physically, but he would walk with you before it's time for your race. You do one lap with him in the grass, and he would walk with you and lay the race out in your mind, right? And then he'll tell you how important this moment is, not for him or for your shoe sponsors or for anybody in the stadium, but how important it is for you, how hard you work for this moment. Don't just give it away. You train day in, day out for this moment. Now this moment is here. What are we going to do? You got to be bigger than the moment. You train to be bigger than the moment. Do not let the moment be bigger than you. So that kind of like gave me more fortitude. It kind of helped me become the warrior that I always stepped onto the track to be, because at that moment, he was the last person I talked to before I went into the call room. And so he ignited me. I had that fire in me. So every time I stepped on the track, I always would be so intense. And a lot of people would be like, man, he's so serious or so angry. But I realized like, I'm just a chill guy away from the track. So a chill guy wasn't going to get the job done. I had to be a warrior. I had to be intense. And if I could be intense for 9 seconds, I'm going to do it.
So we talked a little bit about your training. And did you have some favorite training sessions that you really enjoyed, like going to the gym or some sprints?
You know, I think for most sprinters, including myself, your favorite training sessions are always block starts, because you could talk a little trash there. I talked a lot of trash at practice. I didn't talk a lot of trash in competition. I didn't talk trash during like post interviews or pre-interviews before the races. You know, we always have to give that. I'm just happy to be here. The competitors, you know, are very good. I respect the competitors. But during like block sessions,
it's a whole nother situation.
What? I'll be Muhammad Ali reincarnated. That's what I felt like. I'll just out to just like, look at you. You slow. I hope you need breakfast today because you're about to eat all my dust. You know what I mean? So you talk a lot of trash, but together we were like, have fun, and iron was sharpening iron. So my favorite sessions were always block star sessions.
And on the other side, what's the training sessions you absolutely hated?
Two different training cycles, which was, my coach would call it 5-2-5s, which is you'll run a 500, you'll rest for 2 minutes, you run another 500, you rest for 6 minutes, and then you run a 500, rest for 2 minutes, run another 500, rest, and wow, then you rest. That's only one set. And then you usually have two sets. It's been times where we had three sets of those. Like, it was just torture.
Wow.
Because usually you want to come through that 500 in a minute and a half, and then now you have no time to really rest, because once you turn around, you got to start walking back to the start line again, you know? And then another workout that, I don't know, my body just couldn't understand, which was 100-meter repeats. But our 100-meter repeats were way different. So we would run, and it would kind of be a series of runs that we would go through halfway through the season of like our fall training, going into like our speed endurance training. And it would be run 100 meters, and it could be, let's just say, starts off at like 20 seconds, right? And then you get 10 seconds, and you got to turn right back around and run again. 10 seconds, turn back around and run again. You got to do 5 of those. Then you rest. And you got to go back and do that at least two more sets of those. So as the season progressed, you go from running like this easy 20-second 100-meter runs to now we were running like 10 seconds, 11-second runs. But the rest would never change. It always still would be 10 seconds. So by the time I would get to like that third rep, even in the first set, like I was dry heaving all the time. I was like, ooh. But it was necessary, right? Those are things that we had to do, because the progress of you as an elite sprinter is never going to be an easy road. You have to do something that's going to challenge you. And for all those that think they can pick and choose what's going to be good for you, what's not going to be good for you, that's not for you to decide. It's actually for your coach and to look at the big picture while you focus on what's in front of you. So sometimes you got to step up to the plate and get as much as you can get done at the best of your abilities in those hard workouts.
Absolutely. So my last question always is, if you could give an advice to your younger self, what would it be?
Wow. never limit yourself. Never limit yourself. I felt at times where I was like, I needed to be reserved. I needed to be a little more chill. But I felt like I had so much more potential in me, especially in my younger years, that I felt like I should have just went for it. Like, if you think you can go for a world record, work hard for it. If you think you go out and get an Olympic medal or a world championship medal, go for it. So I think not limiting myself and just really just being a part of the process wholeheartedly would have been a game changer for me.
Wow. Thank you very much, Justin.
Appreciate it, Benjamin. I appreciate it. But same, likewise. I love the show. I'm always watching. And you continue to bring on amazing guests.
That's it for today's episode with the incredible Justin Gatlin. If you enjoyed our conversation, make sure to check out his podcast, Ready, Set, Go, where he talks to athletes and shares inspiring stories. And don't forget to grab a copy of his book, From Grind to Glory, to dive deeper into his journey and the lessons he's learned along the way. If you like this episode, I would really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the podcast and leave a quick review. Your feedback helps us grow and bring more amazing guests like Justin to the show. Thanks for tuning in and see you in the next episode.